Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. And as always, I am joined by my co-host, Frank Cogliano. Frank, where are you this week on your trips through America?
I have finally settled down in one place, David. For the next 4 weeks, I'll be in Palo Alto, California. I've got I'm an international visitor at the Stanford Humanities Center for the next month.
Well, that sounds like a very hard task to fulfill. I hope it's you'll be able to survive that without too much emotional damage.
Somebody's got
to
do it.
Somebody has to do these difficult tasks. That you. Okay, good. Three topics today. One, corruption. Has the United States ever been more corrupt? Probably yes, but we'll talk about that. Two, arts and humanities funding. Trump's recent budget, the America First budget, I think is according to his label for it, which has got all kinds of problems. But the America First budget wants to cut the National Endowment for the Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts. We'll talk about the federal government and arts and the ways in which those have worked together over the past 200 years. And three, a new feature, a mailbag feature in which we answer reader questions. But first, corruption. Frank, one of the big themes of Trump's campaign especially during the last months of Trump's campaign, was to drain the swamp of corruption, and lots of Democrats have recently accused the Trump administration of all kinds of various improprieties. This obsession, though, with corruption isn't new, right? Looking back at your time period, the founders were deeply concerned about corruption. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely, David. The founders, in fact, you could argue that fear of corruption was one of the causes of the American Revolution, because the American colonists, at least some of them, believed that Britain was inherently, and its political system was inherently corrupt, and corrupt beyond redemption, and thus a new start was needed. And the kind of fear of corruption is endemic in 18th century political culture, as is the accusation that one's opponents are corrupt. I mean, for all the many reasons that Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton disagreed with each other, one was that Jefferson firmly believed that Hamilton's fiscal policies and tying the kind of fiscal interest of the country to the government was inherently corrupt. Okay. He couldn't see the benefits of it, for example. And this kind of fear of corruption is present, and the rhetoric about corruption is present in the United States from the very founding of the country. At the same time that there's a great deal of what we might deem corruption and insider trading present throughout the history of the country as well. Yeah. As you'll know, your own century, the 19th century, is rife with corruption, right?
Oh, to be sure. But before we get to all the corruption in the 19th century, I mean, I'm struck by the extent to which, you know, the fear of corruption is one of the sort of overarching, you know, concerns of the revolutionary era. And this is where we get sort of the emoluments clause and all these concerns that, you know, politicians are going to become subject to bribe by foreign states, or somehow going to, you know, enrich themselves for their office, or somehow going to be, partial to special interests. I mean, I seem to remember there being a debate at the Constitutional Convention about whether they should pay government officials, in part because they wanted to make sure they weren't going to be corrupted by their office, and worried that if they weren't paid, they would, you know, hire themselves out to the highest bidder and all these other kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long debate about how much public officials should be paid in the United States, as you know. And on one hand, they want to pay them so that they'll be independent of influence, because the real fear of corruption is kind of unseen influence. Mm. That's the real problem with it, as many people will see on a kind of ideological, from an ideological perspective. But then the other concern is that, well, then people will be seeking public office not to serve the public, but to aggrandize themselves.
Yeah.
And so there's a real kind of tension there between, over the very question of whether and how much public officials should be paid.
Yeah.
And Trump himself made great play during the recent campaign, claiming that he would not take any pay for being president. Now, he's already been paid twice. So he's forgotten that as well. you know, and the president isn't paid all that much, but
he's paid more than I am, but
you know. Yeah, and me. But he's doing a slightly, well, he's not doing it better than you and I are. but it's a difficult job. But he's not necessarily paying commensurate with running a major corporation, for example. So the question of the payment for political servants and public servants, I should say, closely aligns with these concerns over corruption, I think.
Yeah.
Well, recently, I mean, by way of example, I mean, the most famous example, and one of the reasons George Washington is so popular among Americans both during his lifetime and afterwards is because of his apparent selflessness.
Mm.
So Washington famously refused to take any pay for commanding the Continental Army during the War of Independence. And I came across a really, really interesting exchange of letters between Washington and Jefferson during the 1780s recently, when Washington was writing to Jefferson to say, look, the state of Virginia is trying to give me a life interest in a land company in the West in recognition for my service during the War of Independence. And I don't want to accept this because I don't want to appear to be corrupt. But by the same token, I don't want to decline it because I don't want to appear rude.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't say, I don't want it to be a humble brag, but if he were kind of using contemporary language, he'd say, you know, it would look like a humble brag if I'm seen to be declining this.
Sure.
And he's asking Jefferson to use his influence with the Virginia government to stop this initiative. And it's a very interesting comment on how Washington, at least, perceived corruption and pursuing one's own interest in government 240 years ago.
Yeah. Well, there's the other sort of famous example from the time where Ben Franklin is in France and you know, as he's leaving to come back to the United States, the King of France gives him I think it's a portrait of himself, but it's a diamond encrusted portrait of himself. And he, you know, is unsure whether he should accept that or not, but he doesn't want to insult the King of France by refusing it after, you know, being part of the diplomatic corps. And it seems like giving gifts at the end of things were part of the, custom of the time. But when he get back, part of the reason why they end up with things like the emoluments clause is for ways of people to say, look, I can't take these gifts, not because I'm not grateful for your gift or not, you know, willing to be honored, but because I'm not legally allowed to. What point in American history do you think is, you know, there's lots of people who are talking about corruption now and saying, well, you know, has things ever been this corrupt? When do you think corruption was at its height?
Well, you know, one's default position, I suppose, would be to look at the late 19th century, when there seems to be incredible corruption, and with the rise of great corporations like Standard Oil and things like that, that there's incredible corruption in the national government.
Mm.
And indeed, one can interpret the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century as an attempt to redress some of that and to correct and eliminate corruption from American life and politics, which met with a great deal of success. So that's, you know, that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you said in the intro, David, are we living in the most corrupt period in American history? You know, it remains to be seen. And we've only had, I think, 7 weeks of the Trump administration. But the amount of kind of what we would in other times have defined as conflicts of interest, the amount and scale of the apparent conflicts of interest in the Trump administration seem to be pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
As I said, if one looks at the late 19th century, you're talking about decades of corruption as opposed to a few months. But this particular period, you know, the stuff that's come out this week about Michael Flynn being on the payroll not only of the Russians but the Turks at the same time, representing you know, that's pretty corrupt, actually. I mean, I think that would be... What do you think is the most corrupt?
Well, so I'm thinking about this period in the late 19th century, and to be sure, there's a tremendous amount of corruption. But there's also, I think, important to recognize that what is corrupt and what's not corrupt is as much a sort of cultural construct and a judgment as it is sort of an objective standard. There's a really great book that's written at the end of the 19th century by... what part of the corruption is not only at the national level, but at the local level, or especially the local level, by a politician as part of Tammany Hall, the great political machine in New York, which was known as being outrageously corrupt in all kinds of ways. There's this book written by a man named George Washington Plunkett.
Oh, it's a great book.
And Plunkett makes an argument there as an enormously corrupt politician. He says there's honest graft and there's dishonest graft. You know, and he basically is saying there's good corruption and bad corruption. And I only do the good corruption. You know, and he says he makes an argument that's perfectly legitimate for him as a politician to make tons of money off of being a politician, as long as he, doesn't actually steal it out of the government coffers. If, on the other hand, he knows where the government's going to build a bridge and he buys up the real estate beforehand, that, in his mind, seemed like a perfectly legitimate way for him to profit off of his office, and one that he wasn't ashamed of. And in some ways, it seems to be clear that lots of people who voted for him knew that he was making lots of money off of his office, and that the other, machine leaders were making tons of money off of their offices and were okay with it because they were providing other kinds of social services that were not provided for by the state. So Plunkett sort of spends half of his book talking about the ways in which he's making all kinds of money off of his office in ways that we would label corrupt now, but the rest of the time he's going to his constituents and helping them bail them out of jail, and he's paying for their weddings, and he's helping people find jobs, and he's, in exchange for those things, expecting loyalty at the polls, which, I think we would see that as being a kind of corrupt quid pro quo for, how politics is not supposed to work. And the progressives clearly saw this as being a fundamentally corrupt kind of government. That's why they tried to get rid of it. But I'm not sure, though, those are imposing the progressive values on a city that in a time that may not have had the same values that we do.
That's great stuff, and Plunkett's book is fabulous. But what strikes me, David, is about the current moment, and the reason it may be a little bit exceptional, if I can use that word, is because President Trump came in with this rhetoric about draining the swamp, and he said this repeatedly.
Yeah.
So he ran as an outsider at some level, notwithstanding the fact that, he's the billionaire and everything else. He ran as a kind of populist outsider with this anti-corruption rhetoric about draining the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if the early returns are indicative, seems to be engaging in a level of self-aggrandizement that's fairly remarkable.
Yeah.
We've heard about his son-in-law Jared Kushner's new $400 million deal with the Chinese. Every time he goes to Mar-a-Lago instead of Camp David,
sure,
he's enriching himself.
Yeah.
The cost of those trips, it's not just the cost of Air Force One, but it's also the fact that Mar-a-Lago, his resort in Florida, is making money off his presence.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of, there's a real disconnect, it seems to me, between President Trump's rhetoric, anti-corruption rhetoric, and some of his actions, which is does harken back to the 19th century, I think.
Yeah. Well, the other way in which I think there's a profound kind of corruption that's not labeled corruption now, has to do with campaign finance.
Yes.
In my mind, everything, even well before Citizens United, access and influence of politicians was very much predicated upon lobbyists and PACs and campaign donations. It was a system that was, I think, fundamentally broken decades ago, but one that is, since the Citizens United decision, which basically removed lots of these limitations on campaign finance spending, to me, strikes me as a fundamentally corrupting structure on government. So I don't, it partially depends on how, what level of government you're looking for as corruption, because in some ways, all of that corruption is perfectly legal, even if it corrupts the political process. Likewise, you could think of, gerrymandering that's happening, within state legislatures that in congressional districts. I see that as corrupting the political process, even if it's, legal corruption of the political process. I mean, I guess another way of thinking about it is corruption the same as broken government? And in some cases, you can see evidences of illegal corruption. In other cases, you can see legal corruption, but the ones that still make democracy not work the way it should.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, one of our perspectives in this podcast is not only that we're historians of the United States, but that we're expats. And so, yeah, as you were intimating earlier, to some extent, corruption is in the eye of the beholder, and it's very culturally specific. Mm-hmm. So the role of money in U.S. politics, for example, is, or the extent to which money is allowed to influence U.S. politics, is not necessarily prevalent in other countries, including the United Kingdom where we live.
Yeah.
I mean, money plays a role. Of course money plays a role. But it doesn't play the same role that it does in the U.S. They have not equated money with speech, for example, in the U.K. where we live, as the Supreme Court has in the United States. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, during a campaign, all the parties are given equal time on television, for sure. example. And that's a, you know, that's a government-mandated rule.
Yeah.
That would be unthinkable in the United States. So you're absolutely right. The corruption can take many different forms, I think. But whether we're living in a particularly corrupt age, I think things seem to be more corrupt than they were 30 or 40 years yeah. ago, I guess. I don't know whether we've reached the height of the 1880s and 90s, or the low rather than the high.
Exactly.
But we seem to be trending in the wrong direction right now. But as I said earlier, the you know the 1880s and 90s were followed by the Progressive Period, and a period of real reform within the government against some corrupt practices. So we may be that kind of moment of reform is coming as well.
Okay, well we'll have to revisit this topic in 10 years, and we'll see whether gerrymandering, campaign finance, and all other kinds of problems with democracy are fixed. If that's you know, in the cards. All right, topic number two. Trump's new budget seems to suggest that he wants to end the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities. This has obviously been a longstanding part of the conservative platform that wants to cut all kinds of government programs, and especially these arts programs. Frank, I think both of us deeply love the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. At least that's my supposition. The origin of these programs goes back to the 1960s with the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, but this wasn't the first time the government got interested in the arts. In the Revolutionary period and in the early Republic, what concerns did the founders and their successors think about the role of art and the role of government?
Well, they believed that art was essential to shaping the political culture and indeed a healthy the kind of healthy body politic depended on a populace that was well informed and was conversant in the arts, in fact. And so if you think about the public architecture of the early Republic, and again, my guy Jefferson has a lot to do with this, the introduction of so-called Palladian architecture in American public life. This is really, really important. On one hand, it's hearkening back to the classical period and echoing classical models. But on the other, it's meant to educate and influence the public and in quite important ways. And one sees this in the development of Washington, D.C. in the early Republic, but especially during your period in the mid to later 19th century, yeah. when you know the great public buildings and monuments in the nation's capital are erected, and those are built and installed and developed in part because there's a recognition that art is political. So the yeah. critics of the NEH and the NEA do understand that. They see this as being political and antithetical to their own political views. And they're not necessarily wrong about that. They might question whether they actually want to be in a political movement that's opposed to the arts and what that says about them.
Sure.
But there's a recognition that art plays a role in shaping political culture, I think.
Yeah, no, and that, you know, the government has a role in promoting the arts, you know, seems to be, you know, an important part of you know, what the founding generation wanted to do. I mean, thinking about, you know, even the parts in the Constitution about protecting copyright, they talk about the importance there about, you know, promoting the arts and sciences.
That's right.
That, you know, the federal government has a role in doing that, even if it's simply in giving copyright protection, which is, you know, no small thing. You know, and thinking closer to the, you know, modern period, you know, there's a huge amount of government spending in the arts in the Great Depression. One of the important parts of the New Deal that people don't think about, but is I think actually has a fairly long legacy, is the government recognized that, you know, not only do they need to find jobs for industrial workers during the Great Depression, not only do they need to help farmers who were devastated by low crop prices and all these other kinds of things, but they needed to provide for unemployed artists, unemployed writers. And there's a phenomenal number of government projects built or paid for by the executive branch during the New Deal. Things like there's a federal writers project that writes studies of each of the states. There's part of the federal writers project that does interviews with former slaves. This is a part of the Works Progress Administration, something a source I use all the time in my own research and teaching. They paint murals also on post office. Some of these are still around. There are lots of unemployed artists who go on to you know, very important careers. I think Rothko originally was painting for the WPA. I think Jackson Pollock also for a while was you know, a federal government sponsored you know, artist. And so, you know, there's a critical role that they recognized even in the heights of the Depression, that the government needed to support the arts when no other bodies could.
Yeah, I mean, Winston Churchill, and I don't know whether this quote is apocryphal or not, is said to have said, when asked about whether Britain should continue funding the arts during wartime,
yeah,
well, if we don't, what are we fighting for? And to some extent, I think of the WPA projects during the Depression in those ways. I think that there was a recognition that, you know, it was a time of emergency, and the WPA was about creating work for American workers at some level. And so if the workers in question were writers or painters, they were put to work writing and painting.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you say, the legacy of that is quite important. And you do still see those murals in post offices, yeah, around the country. And it's quite it's an interesting moment, I guess. And you're quite right to mention it as a kind of antecedent to the NEH, yeah, and the NEA today. I guess the crucial difference is there was the New Deal was premised on the belief that those circumstances during the Depression were exceptional and would pass.
Yeah.
Whereas the NEA and the NEH have institutionalized government support for the arts,
yeah,
in really important ways and in ways that have really borne fruit and paid off in far beyond the relatively modest investment, I think. I mean, as you'll know, you and I have seen lots of examples on social media in the past few weeks of from different scholars, of people who've kind of taken pictures of their bookcases and identified the books in those bookcases that were partially funded by NEH grants. And it's huge. I mean, in our own profession as historians, the historical profession in the United States has been greatly enhanced by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And the same could be said for the arts, the NEA, I think.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even get to, sorry, David, it doesn't even get to the importance of public television and public radio,
mm-hmm,
which are really where the vast majority of Americans encounter or benefit from this funding for the arts.
Yeah. I mean, you can think about sort of the Ken Burns Civil War series or some of the other things he's done. A lot of that have been funded by NEH grants or, you know, and lots of NEH grants go to state arts councils, and then those get distributed, and state humanities councils, a lot of those get distributed to local projects. So I think there are lots of ways in which even the, you know, the small sliver of the federal budget that's made to these programs, you know, that filters throughout the country in ways I think people aren't fully aware of, that oftentimes their local museums and local theaters are being supported, at least in part, by these grants.
That's right. And, you know, I read one analysis over the past 2 days since Trump's budget came out that said, actually, the reason conservatives hate the NEA and the NEH is because they believe that these are programs that benefit liberals on either coast, on the East and West coasts, and that it's a little bit of a way of, you know, waging the culture war against them. Yet, in terms of the real benefits for the money spent, you know, liberals on either coast actually are the beneficiaries of living in if we subscribe to that stereotype, which itself is flawed, but are the beneficiaries of lots of living in regions with lots of artistic, with lots of support for the arts and humanities in terms of private institutions, museums, and so on, and that it's in the states of the interior of the United States where people really benefit from NEH and NEA funding, and that where they will really feel the pinch. So the kind of people who the opponents of the NEH and the NEA want to harm won't really be harmed by this, probably, to the extent that some of their own constituents will be, if it passes. Now, it should be said, it's not clear to me that this budget proposal is going to pass because it's already aroused a lot of antipathy in Congress, so we'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, though, that the NEH and NEA are going to survive. Mm-hmm. I really deeply hope they do. But
I'm not optimistic either.
It remains to be seen, I think.
I mean, in some ways, what the debate's going on now are there's some strong continuities with some of the culture wars of, you know, the 1990s, I think, are still very present. That, you know, this idea that especially the NEA gives grants to, and there's always sort of these two or three outrageous cases that get cited over and over again that people see as being offensive in some way or not real art or what have you.
Right.
And you know, people point to those examples and ignore the other 99% of it, which, you know, is incontrovertible as having, you know, artistic merit and what have you.
But I think it's also a case where it's, you know, here we have and this has happened repeatedly with the Trump administration. It's almost like a case of a dog that chases the car and actually catches the car and doesn't know what to do with it. So the NEH and the NEA have been worth more to conservatives as foils that they could use to kind of rail against than to actually, now they have the power and the authority to get rid of them. I'm not sure they really meant to get rid of them necessarily, but now they're stuck in a bind where for 30 years they've been railing against them, and now they feel like they have to do something about it. But, you know, it's going to be very tough for them. Okay, so it's all right when it's art that's controversial or offensive or what have you.
Yeah.
And you're right, they always give the examples, you know, the same couple of examples get trotted out. But they're going to face cutting Big Bird.
Yes. Although Big Bird, I think, Sesame Street's already gone to HBO.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. But well, you know what I mean, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Dora the Explorer, what you know, because there are programs that are on, NEA-funded programs on television, on public television and public radio, that people across the political spectrum love.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. Here's historical tidbits of no value whatsoever, but an interesting footnote considering our current time. Do you know where the NEH was headquartered for most of its lifetime?
I do not.
At the old post office.
Really?
And, of course, the old post office is now the Trump International Hotel. I have no idea what that means, if anything. I think it's just an interesting sort of coincidence that one of the bodies he's trying to kill used to live where his hotel is. Make of that what you will.
Okay.
All right. So our third topic, we're introducing a new feature. Hopefully this will be a recurring feature, a mailbag feature. I asked on Twitter and Facebook for questions from our listenership of things you wanted us to answer. We got a few responses, but I wanted to sort of highlight one in particular from Katie, a listener here in the UK, and the question is there anything currently, any reasons to be cheerful? Frank, we've been kind of downers here the past, you know, 2 months. What should we be cheerful about or optimistic about given the present sort of political climate?
I mean, I'm a cheerful guy anyway, David.
Well, as am I. I'm trying to be upbeat about.
I'm in California, so I have lots of reasons to be cheerful right now. But I do think there are some reasons to be cheerful. I think we've seen the system tested in a lot of ways, and we have lots of reasons to be upset, depressed, perhaps. However, a couple of things give me hope. One is the response of the courts, and we saw this again this week with the second version of Trump's travel ban being not struck down but put on hold by an appeals court in Hawaii, for example. The judiciary has done its job in the past 7 weeks, and it's done the job it was intended to do. There's a reason. I mean, I don't think Mr. Trump understands the way the judiciary works, but there's a reason that the judiciary is meant to be independent under the Constitution, and it has functioned as such. The second thing that's given me hope is the response of the media. Now, I think the media has a lot to answer for in terms of the rise and indeed the election of Trump. I think the media was supine early on when it treated Trump as a joke and as clickbait and everything else.
Yeah.
But since the inauguration, I think the media has really got its mojo back and acted in a really effective manner to keep people informed and to, you know, it's an important element of the. Of the system in the United States,
yeah.
And it seems to have reemerged. I'm thinking about the reporting, especially in the New York Times and Washington Post, but other entities, particularly online entities as well. And so I think the media response has been quite good. I'm also heartened by the response of the public. I mean, we mustn't forget, first of all, that Trump lost by 3 million votes in terms of the popular vote. But I've spent a considerable amount of time, as you know, traveling in the United States since January, and the public response and the kind of emergence of a quite passionate resistance is a phrase that's being used. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether we want to use that, but there's been a re-engagement by the public with these kind of questions. Everybody's talking about politics right now. So these three things give me cause for hope and optimism, I think. What about yourself? Do you see?
Yeah, I guess I'm seeing the same sort of lights. I am equally impressed by the ability of the courts to function independently. I'm a little bit concerned about how Trump is going to respond to the courts and the ways in which, there was one of Trump's surrogates, earlier this week he was at the Hermitage for Andrew Jackson's birthday, encouraging Trump to follow Andrew Jackson's example by ignoring the courts, which is wrong on 12 kinds of levels. The least of which is that ignoring the courts was a form of genocide in that case. But to the extent to which Trump is going to respect the judicial independence, I'm concerned about that, but I think the courts have been a sight of something to be proud of. The courts have, for the most part, been a sight of optimism, at least for me. I'm also encouraged by the response, the ways in which the American populace has been politically engaged in a way that I have not seen in my lifetime, to be quite honest. The political apathy that has been sort of a defining feature of American politics for a large segment of the population. I think those days are gone, at least for the time being. I'm curious to see what voter turnout is going to be like at the midterm, because voter turnout wasn't great in this last election. So I'd be curious to see how this activism translate. And I think, like you, I've been impressed for the most part with how the press has responded. Although I'd like to see more solidarity among the press than I've seen. I think the reporting has been very good, especially by Some of the networks are doing a good job. I think likewise, the sort of big independent newspapers, the Times and the Post, have been very good. But I kind of wish that the media would be, and I guess I'm being pessimistic about things we're supposed to be optimistic about, but I guess that's my move sometimes. You know, when Republicans refuse to take questions from CNN or other sort of media outlets that they think are critical of them, I'd like to see the rest of the journal, the press corps, you know, fall in line saying, if you're not taking questions from CNN, you're not going to take questions from any of us. But like you, I'm been impressed and generally happy with how the press has behaved. And I've been encouraged by especially how the involvement of young people in this, you know, particular moment. I think there's a ways in which university students have gotten involved. I think there's ways in which people who are not even old enough to vote have been politically engaged by this moment. And I think there's going to be a long tail for that going forward, that, you know, there's going to be people who are, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years from now are going to say, this is the moment that I got interested in politics and thought that I needed to get involved. So I think that's something to be optimistic about.
Yeah, I agree. And one area where the kind of public and the judiciary came together, I think, was in that second week of the Trump administration, when he tried to implement the travel ban the first time, when lawyers in their hundreds went to airports and offered pro bono legal advice. And indeed, it was the first time I could remember in living memory that kind of lawyers became popular heroes. And, you know, we saw lawyers sitting on the floors of airplane terminals with their laptops, you know, drafting writs of habeas corpus. You know, that was really, that was a really important moment, I think.
I think so, too. I mean, that was odd to see people praising lawyers to that extent, which, you know, as a child of lawyers, doesn't happen that much, usually. especially New York lawyers, who were all then at JFK, thought that New York lawyers would be the heroes of a story, if anything, is, you know, not part of the script that I was anticipating. So there are things to... I think there are lots of things to be optimistic about, even if you know, it looks like Armageddon is upon us sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we will not know for another few years whether Trump's election and Trumpism is the kind of spasmodic last throw of white supremacy and on the way to something better, or whether it was a turn to something far worse. And time will tell. But I think some of these underlying phenomena give us cause for hope.
All right. So I hope, Katie, I hope that gave you some reasons to have some hope. Frank and I are always eager for questions from listeners. So whether you'd like to tweet at us or send us, you know, a Facebook message or whatever it is, we'd love to have questions for our next mailbag segment. So it's time for Last Drops. Frank, what do you got?
Well, I saw today is St. Patrick's Day. I don't know when people are going to listen to it, but it's Friday, the 17th of March. And there was a story in the New York Times today, one of the things about Irish slaves. And you'll know, David, as somebody who is a historian of slavery, among other things, that a very, very persistent belief in certain quarters of the internet and beyond is this notion that the Irish were enslaved too, especially in America.
Yes.
And the story in the Times made a very good point. They interviewed some very kind of heroic Irish academics and librarians who were working against this view, because one sees it persistently, especially in memes.
Yes.
And it usually, the memes run the, usually are something like, it'll be a photograph of somebody alleged to be Irish, working under difficult conditions, and the phrasing will say something like, you know, the Irish were enslaved too. You don't see them asking for welfare handouts.
Yeah.
And there's a clear racist, it's not even an undertone, there's a racist tone and racist message behind this, the implication being that the descendants of enslaved African Americans are somehow looking for special treatment by comparison with the Irish in an American context. And this article, and we as historians know this is nonsense, but this article really broke down the fact that how persistent this belief is, but also how inherently and deeply flawed it is. I commend the essay, the article to everyone. It notes that, yes, the Irish, many Irish came to America in the 17th and 18th and even into the 19th centuries as either indentured servants or in response to real duress, but their status was never that of slaves.
Yeah.
And it's an important reminder on this day of all days. That's not to say that the Irish didn't suffer, of course not, in any kind of context, but it kind of puts paid to this persistent and nefarious myth.
Yeah, so talk about fake news. That's an example of fake history that I think has been amazingly persistent, despite the fact the evidence requires willfully misreading a whole lot of evidence in order to sort of come up with anything. But that's an important article, and I think an important time to think about it.
Yeah, we can link to it on our page. What's your last drop, David?
So I want to endorse the U.S. consulate here in Edinburgh.
Oh, amen.
Yes, they've been good friends to both of us for at least all the time I've been here, and I know you've been here a lot longer. But we've been critical very much of.
They're my first call if I end up in jail, David.
Yes, exactly. If I lose my passport, I know where to find them. But we've been very critical of things that have been going on in the federal government in recent months. But the U.S. consulate has demonstrated to me over and over again the ways in which there are lots of people, most people who work in the federal government, who are deeply interested in the welfare of the United States and sharing a vision of the United States to the rest of the world that's maybe not the same vision of the United States that the White House is sharing. And there have been a couple of things that the consulate has done recently that I sure wanted to point out. One is Susan Wilson, the principal officer at the consulate, came to the meeting of the Scottish Association for the Study of America, SASA, which had its annual meeting a couple weeks ago, which I endorsed last week. She came to come to the conference, and she actually did that last year, the previous year as well, when it was at Stirling. And more recently, the consulate was involved in sponsoring a Women's Day talk at the National Library, that, in fact, we mentioned this also in the last episode, which is to say that the consulate is doing a tremendous amount of work, not only representing the citizens of the United States who are overseas and people like Frank and I who live here, but also all the tourists who come and visit, but also in sort of sharing American culture. And even if the, NEH and the NEA die in the recent budget, there are parts of the government that are really trying to share all that America has to offer overseas that should be applauded. So kudos to the American consulate here in Edinburgh, who've done some really great work in some interesting times to do it.
Hear, hear. I completely endorse what you've said, David. Absolutely.
All right. Until next time, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. I just wanted to remind people that we are doing our book giveaway, so please leave a review on iTunes, and we will select two randomly selected reviews. I've noticed we've gotten a few more reviews, both on the UK iTunes and on the US iTunes, but more reviews we get, the easier for people to find us, so please subscribe and write a review. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at Whiskey Rebel Pod. Until next time, Frank, cheers.
Cheers, David.